The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Bill Press Pod. I'm Jason Dick, Deputy Editor at CQ Roll Call, and I'm hosting this week while Bill is off. This Friday's roundtable of journalists will try to make sense of what has become an extraordinary congressional train wreck. It's not an exaggeration to say that there's a lot riding on the next month or so. The fate of the Biden agenda, the issues that will define the 2022 midterm elections, and who wins the majorities in the House and Senate, and, oh yeah, the U.S. and world economy. There are four things making this seem like a large pileup: raising the debt ceiling, funding the government to avoid a government shutdown, passing the Senate's bipartisan infrastructure bill, and passing pretty much Biden's whole agenda in the Build Back Better bill. The truth is that government funding and the debt ceiling will almost certainly pass at some point, but it will be ugly and scary and down to the wire. There is another potential train wreck, though, among Democrats on infrastructure and the Build Back Better agenda. Again, both these at some point will probably pass in some form, but what's in the Build Back Better bill, tax hikes for the rich, spending on soft infrastructure, climate change, healthcare, childcare, all that is kind of up for grabs right now. It's a lot to go through, but the stakes are about as high as they get in Washington. Joining me today to talk about these topics and more are Maya King, politics reporter for Politico. Good morning, Maya.
Good morning.
Sarah Weyer, Congress reporter for the LA Times. Hi, Sarah.
How you doing?
Very good. And Alex Rorty, White House correspondent for McClatchy News. Howdy, Alex.
Jason, a pleasure as always.
Excellent. Special shout out to Sarah and Alex joining us on the Bill Press Pod for the first time for the roundtable. Let's start with Congress. Let's start with you, Sarah. What we saw this week was a lot of back and forth. You know, we knew that this was going to be a significant week because for the first time in since July, both chambers were actually in session on Monday and almost made it a full entire week of week before some people headed for the exits. But we were at this sort of area where we just don't know how they're going to resolve the debt limit and government funding thing. Let's listen. We've got a clip from Mitch McConnell where he kind of lays out that if the Democrats want to pass a debt limit extension or a debt limit suspension, they're going to have to do it on their own. They want to couple it with the government funding bill, but Mitch basically says that's not going to happen. Let's listen to that clip now.
My advice to this Democratic government, the president, the House, and the Senate, don't play Russian roulette with our economy. Step up and raise the debt ceiling to cover all that you've been engaged in all year long. So no effort on their part to describe our position as irresponsible makes any sense.
Sir, it seems like the majority or the minority leader, Mitch McConnell, there is sort of trying to head off some arguments that this is a shared responsibility. Democrats have pointed out that when Republicans were in full control of the government, they had no problem running up the debt in the form of tax cuts. And they also have supported a lot of the coronavirus relief over the last couple of years. How is it that we find ourselves in this position?
Well, for Republicans, the longer they can keep Democrats focused on four different topics at once, the better off they are. They know it's going to drag the process down and Democrats aren't going to be able to get as much done. You know, Democrats don't like playing games with the debt ceiling, but we've really seen in the last few years that Republicans are more willing to kind of step up to the edge of the abyss. And I don't see that changing this time. I wouldn't want to get into a staring contest with Mitch McConnell. He has no reason to blink right now.
That's absolutely right. And I'm glad you brought up the sort of the negotiating patterns here too, because in general, You know, we don't see a lot of government shutdowns. We saw a couple during the Trump years, another one back in 2013, and then there were the big ones in the 90s. But the Democrats usually don't use this as effectively. You know, they don't threaten government shutdowns, and they certainly don't threaten debt limit breaches. That's the Republican sort of viewpoint, and they seem very willing to deploy that. Whereas Democrats are like, well, we're obviously not going to have a government shutdown. That kind of puts them at the disadvantage right away, right?
Yeah, I think Republicans reason that eventually Democrats will buckle and get this done. There's no way that Democrats are going to break the economy when they need it to succeed in 2022. Pelosi doesn't like votes that she's not going to win, but you know, they're going to hold this vote on Monday evening for the debt limit and the government funding through December. But you know, this is the point in the year where they posture. And if we were having the same conversation in December, I'd be a lot more worried about a shutdown.
And Alex, one thing that we saw from the administration is that the Office of Management and Budget sent out a notice to government agencies that they should prepare for a shutdown. Tell us about this. Whether is this something that starts to set off alarm bells everywhere?
Jason, it obviously does. And I mean, Jen Psaki, you know, during yesterday's briefing, even acknowledged. And keep in mind, this is usually a very circumspect White House that does not like to acknowledge problems, even if they're obvious to the rest of us, but they are acknowledging that this would be a major problem. And that it's even in the amount of bandwidth that it's taking, both from officials in the administration, but also throughout our federal government, that they're having to think about this instead of, say, just as a random example, combating the pandemic, right? Because Jen Psaki again was asked yesterday about what effect this could have on health agencies. In the past, health agencies have described previous government shutdowns, which have become kind of a regular part of Washington life over the last decade, as incredibly difficult situations for them. And that was when there wasn't a pandemic, right? And so the White House has been clear that this is going to be a major problem, not just for the White House, but throughout the federal government. And they're trying as best they can to urge Republicans to reverse course and to work with them and not shut down government, to not breach the debt limit. I don't think anyone's holding out hope that Republicans are going to be listening to them anytime soon.
And I mean, what you said about, you know, this has become an almost semi-regular thing. I mean, the last time we really flirted dangerously with the debt limit, Joe Biden was the vice president. He worked out a deal, not just on the debt limit, but on averting several tax hikes and government shutdown with Mitch McConnell. We're not seeing any evidence that there is this sequel to that buddy cop movie, right? With Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden.
It's funny when you think back to that time. I think it was 2013, and Mitch McConnell and Mitch McConnell's advisors would actually actively praise the president. Right. And call him a good faith negotiator, someone that they respected, someone who understood Capitol Hill. You know, flash forward 8 years now in the first year of Biden's presidency. And it doesn't seem as if any of that goodwill has lasted. And we haven't yet seen a chance for the president to really work some of his magic on Capitol Hill in the way that we saw when he was Obama's vice president. You know, we have sort of the makings of a bipartisan deal on infrastructure. We saw a little bit of it there. And if he's able to get that across the finish line, yes, you know, the president would have proved a lot of doubters wrong about his ability to negotiate on Capitol Hill. But I think, you know, this is the kind of the moment we're in, broadly speaking, Jason, I think, is whether or not, you know, Joe Biden, with his 36 years of experience in the Senate, can still navigate, you know, a legislative chamber that has changed a lot, even since he was last in the Senate in 2009, and maybe even has changed a lot since 2013, when he last negotiated some of these deals on behalf of the Obama administration.
And Maya, I mean, one thing, you know, I just am always struck by. I mean, as you know, Alex mentioned, like these are sort of semi-regular government shutdowns or the threats of government shutdowns. And I'm sort of nonplussed by them because they always do figure to get away, you know, through them. I wonder though, I mean, like you're surveying kind of the politics of this. Do voters care about this stuff?
You know, I don't think so, but it's kind of a yes and no answer from me, at least. Voters aren't following, you know, the ins and outs of Biden's negotiations with key senators on the Hill day to day, the ways that we are. But they will feel the impact of a possible government shutdown via loss of jobs and just the general discomfort and discord that a government shutdown can cause. And at this time, the Democrats are trying to use passage of this massive piece of legislation to craft their message for 2022. If this does fail, they have a lot less to stand on heading into next year. And you're already starting to see, I think, that sense of concern, even nervousness among party leaders around Biden's agenda and the ways that it's flailing in Congress. I'm not going to clear any of this dead on arrival, but you know, it's certainly not lost on me that policing and voting rights have kind of fallen to the wayside in Congress. At the same time that Biden needs to pass a massive infrastructure bill and keep the government funded. So there are a lot of different issues floating around that voters aren't really focused on right now. I don't get the sense that they are following this as closely. But in the next few weeks and months, as all of this starts to take shape and we're able to kind of look back on what exactly was accomplished this week and next, I think that's when we'll start to hear from voters. And it also is going to give Republicans plenty of fodder for a lot of their attacks and criticisms of this administration and of Democratic control of Washington.
And actually, like to your point, among the group of senators that appeared with McConnell earlier this week to say that, you know, this is all on Democrats. They need to own this vote on the debt limit. We're willing to avert a government shutdown, but they need to do the debt limit on their own. And we'll get to some of those complications later about how that would work. But Rick Scott, the Republican senator from Florida, who also runs the Republicans' campaign arm in the Senate, he was very like unabashed in saying like, oh, we're just gonna nail Democrats with this. They're gonna own this, and it's you see it in the messaging in some of the releases, you know, that people like us get, right? I mean, this is part of the midterm strategy, at least for Rick Scott, right?
Yeah, and it's a little bit disingenuous, right? Because Republicans have they don't have a majority in Washington, but they still have a say and they still have influence on whether or not this passes. They've chosen to use that influence to say, if the government shuts down, if this agenda sinks, we can just blame this on Democrats' control of Washington. But that's a really, at least in my view, as someone who largely covers campaigns and watches Congress as an influence on campaigns, I understand the strategy. But at the same time, it's it puts Democrats in this terrible position. But it also it makes Republicans just look very much like this is their only goal is to win and not exactly to govern. And I think that is something that they're going to have to watch out for if Democrats indeed start to actually go on the offensive with their messaging.
And Sarah, we've got until September 30th, you know, in this fiscal year. Right now, the short-term continuing resolution, they call it, that would fund the government just at its current levels. It passed the House this past week. It funds government through December, and then it also contains the debt limit suspension, and, as well as billions of dollars for disaster aid and to help settle Afghan refugees. That's now, you know, that'll get a Senate vote where it'll probably be blocked early in the week. And then where are we? You know, with the clock is ticking. We saw some evidence that the senior appropriators in the Senate were meeting to try to figure out maybe Plan B, another short term, different stripped down version. But where is all that? Is this going to make for a pretty like crazy week this coming one?
I mean, I'm not making any plans on September 30th. I advise you not to do it the same. But, you know, it's going to be a bit of a crazy week. Like I said, you've got Democrats' attention split between these four issues. And obviously the government funding portion is the most pressing because it has the earliest deadline. I mean, Congress is a lot like a college student, that they work best under deadlines. And so I can see this possibly happening piecemeal. You know, Democrats included the disaster aid funding, number one, because it needs to be done, but number two, because it can be a sweetener for Republicans, especially in southern states, who are hit hard by the hurricanes. But it doesn't look like it's going to be enough. It does look like they're going to have to separate them out.
And Alex, this separation, this just takes time, right? And the Biden people know that, you know, they can't, every week that they lose is another week that they're not, you know, sort of gaining on the broader agenda of the infrastructure stuff. I mean, as you said, the Biden White House doesn't like to, you know, appear fazed by anything, but they've got to know that, especially after August, which was just really kind of awful for them. You know, they dealt with crisis after crisis. Do they even with a wink and a nod to you and your brethren in the press corps, that this is kind of crunch time?
You know, it's interesting you say that, Jason, because it's actually been remarkable to me the degree to which they are acknowledging that this is crunch time. That Jen Psaki, over the last couple of days, in fact, in the White House press briefing, will acknowledge that presidents were elected to navigate crises. And she actually used that word crises yesterday. And that this is, you know, that they're not going to shy away from it. They're going to embrace it. And so I think it has really sort of underscored the stakes in Washington and for this administration that they're really even willing to acknowledge openly that this is, as you say, is going to be crunch time. And you know, this is the backdrop for the White House right now, is that, you know, as you alluded to, his approval ratings have cratered in the last month. He was down to 43% in Gallup. He was down to, in a poll released this week, he was down to 44% in Pew. I think it was roughly a 10-point drop from July. And it's a broadly felt drop. It's a lot of different demographic groups in these polls, including Black voters, including even registered Democratic voters. He's shown, you know, a loss of support there. And we can talk about there are a lot of reasons for this. It could be the withdrawal from Afghanistan. It could be the coronavirus pandemic. There is a behind the scenes argument going on right now, or at least a difference of opinion among Democrats about what the reason is, why his numbers are falling at this point. But it's a point in the White House presidency that seems like it is either going to, could, at least in the early part of his presidency, either define or derail his presence. That's the moment we've arrived at over the course of the next 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, how they manage all of these different challenges.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break, but I did want to also note that this morning, the Bipartisan Policy Center estimated that the Treasury Department will run out of ways to avoid a debt breach sometime between October 15th to November 4th. And again, the Treasury Department has not said, given it any kind of date certain, other than, you know, around the middle to end of October. The Bipartisan Policy Center, you know, is staffed by people like Bill Hoagland, who's maybe the foremost budget expert. So it is this singular moment. All right, we're going to take a quick break here on the Bill Press Pod Reporters Roundtable. I'm Jason Dick, sitting in for Bill, along with Maya King, Sarah Weyer, and Alex Rory.
Today's podcast brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers, the AFT, under President Randy Weingarten. 1.7 million teachers, men and women of America, doing God's work every day in the classroom, pre-K, K through 12, and higher education as well. They're the ones who've been meeting COVID head on, first on the online classes for over a year, and now back in the classroom, where they're keeping our kids safe and themselves safe by wearing a mask and making sure the kids do too. We salute America's teachers, members of the AFT, thank them for their great work, and thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right, we're back with Maya King, politics reporter for Politico, Sarah Weier, Congress reporter for the LA Times, and Alex Rorty, White House correspondent for McClatchy News. I'm Jason Dick, the deputy editor at CQ Roll Call. All right. I think we can move past a little bit on debt limit and government shutdowns. We've kind of given the broader parameters. We could really geek out on budget stuff if we wanted to, but let's keep our powder dry because it does relate a little bit to infrastructure. And right now, what we're seeing is that we've got these two big infrastructure packages that are linked. And, you know, for lack of a better terms, we'll call them hard infrastructure and soft infrastructure. The hard infrastructure is the Senate's bipartisan infrastructure bill. It passed earlier this summer with, you know, notable bipartisan support. It's in the House now. And once it got to the House, several of the members of the progressive wing of the party said, "We're not going to lend our votes on this unless you also pass this broader bill, soft infrastructure, you call it, that addresses climate change, healthcare, childcare. I mean, a fairly broad sort of expansion of the social safety net, and a far more expensive bill to the tune of, you know, $3.5 trillion in some estimates." We've seen a lot of something that we don't normally see, which is Republicans, particularly in the Senate, lobbying their own colleagues in the House to support a bill that the Democratic majority has control over. These are people like Rob Portman, Mitt Romney, and so forth. I mean, the same kind of question about the debt limit and government shutdowns. What sort of signal does this send to voters, and do voters respond to things like infrastructure? It's been a long time since we've seen a bill this big that addresses infrastructure, building bridges and so forth. But again, you know, is this a viable sort of campaign strategy, and you know, does good policy make good politics?
I think good policy makes good politics in this scenario, because you're talking about things that voters are really asking for, and that makes you sound like a really good retail politician, like bridges and roads and potholes and and buildings and schools. Like, these are the things that voters can actually respond pretty positively to. Early on in this debate around infrastructure, you heard a lot of Republicans saying that this was way too much and way too expensive. And as you point out, you see a bit of an about face here now with more Republicans embracing this infrastructure bill, both because they need it, I think, in many ways to show for their time in Washington and actually be able to bring something home to their constituents. But also, I mean, even more obviously, the fact that American infrastructure is really in dire need of a facelift at this point. This is probably one of the only instances where you can see some reasonable bipartisanship and some actual commitment to getting something done that has real tangible results for voters under President Biden. And that's obviously a big win for Democrats because they're able to, again, craft a message around what they can bring to voters, and also to Republicans who are able to show that they're willing to exhibit, I guess, some level of bipartisanship for this bill. The big question, though, of course, is whether or not it actually passes and how Democrats will be able to smooth over their differences internally over the definitions of infrastructure, as you pointed out, hard and soft, and figure out just what this dollar sign is going to be on this package to actually get it through.
One of the things I was struck by, too, this past week is we saw Gary Peters, who's a Democrat from Michigan. He won a pretty close race for re-election in 2020. He was a little bit behind the eight ball for quite a bit of the re-election campaign, but pulled it out. He is now Rick Scott's counterpart, but among the Democrats. He runs the Democrats' campaign arm. And he's one of those guys that, I mean, I quite literally just stole his phrase, good policy makes good politics. And it seems like Peters is almost, he and Scott couldn't be paired better in some ways. I mean, Scott's going sort of for the jugular on things like debt limit and, you know, like starting to define, you know, Democrats as being about the debt limit. And Peters is this like, nope, we're going to organize and we're going to explain things to people and talk about these issues. And you know, he got a lot of good experience doing that in his reelection campaign. And in a 50-50 Senate, I mean, it's just it's weird. You just couldn't see you could not script this any better in terms of like this. People will be given a very clear choice, it seems, between, you know, like one party over another.
And I think that's the most effective form of messaging at this moment when voters are really caught up in a number of different issues. Democrats' calculus for the last few weeks has been that COVID is the big thing that's front of mind for folks still. That's what's going to mobilize voters. That's what's going to get them to the polls. But it's interesting to hear Peters, on the other hand, kind of slow things down and say, no, we're actually going to explain what people are getting in infrastructure. Voters can walk and chew gum at the same time, essentially. They can be worried about COVID, but they can also see what we're working on in Congress and let that be a motivating factor for them to not only put Democrats back in office, but expand their majority in the Senate. Whether or not this is effective, I'm not sure, but I do actually believe that explaining things in clear terms, letting voters understand exactly what they're getting in a lot of scenarios works pretty well. And I think that more Democrats would want to consider this as a strategy, especially when, as we discussed even at the beginning of this show, the GOP is willing to pull Democrats in a number of different directions right now. That muddies the water, that kind of obscures the message that either party is trying to send. But on something like infrastructure, it's a lot easier, I think, for politicians to actually come forward and say, no, this is what we're pushing for. This is what you can get. And if they actually do push it through, it'll be very easy to point to a stronger bridge, a new road, a better school, actual physical infrastructure, and even some soft infrastructure as well, funding for public health, climate change, items like that, and say, this is what we were able to accomplish over the last few months in Congress. It's just hard for Democrats now because they've tried to squeeze all of this essentially into a 3-week window to actually get it passed.
Yeah, and Sarah, I mean, like we'll see the first big test of this next week when, I mean, they made a, the Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, made a deal with moderates that they would get a vote on this bipartisan infrastructure bill, the hard infrastructure bill, on the 27th, which is Monday. We might see maybe some movement on that. Who knows if they get close? But that seems to the more liberal wing of the party wants the vote closer to the broader soft infrastructure package. I mean, is this just too much to bite off? I mean, are we going to see that, you know, those two votes this coming week?
Well, according to Pelosi, yes. we'll see if it actually happens. She's a little bit optimistic, I think, but she's ordered the committees to work this weekend and start marking up that soft infrastructure bill. And you know, a markup just kind of means finalized, but that doesn't mean that that's the text that's actually going to pass in the long run. You know, the thing the moderates are the most worried about is that they'll sign on to a much larger bill than the Senate is going to be willing to swallow, and that they'll be lambasted with that vote in 2022. Pelosi really needs progressives to kind of back off and give her some breathing room right now, because she's got to mollify the moderates, but also recognize that the progressives make up a much bigger portion of her caucus. It kind of goes back to what I said about Mitch McConnell and staring contest. I wouldn't want to play chess against Nancy Pelosi. She's often far ahead of the rest of us, but it looks like she's going to try to at least show that there's movement on the hard infrastructure of this bill, and hopes that mollifies the progressives a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, she's only got three votes to spare at any given moment because of vacancies and just like the close margins. It's as close to a 50-50 Senate in the House as you can get almost. But it also seems that, like, you know, the Republican leadership is trying to make it more difficult for her by whipping against the bill, against the Senate bill, which makes it all the more important for her to shore up her own ranks. And then we've got this, you know, situation where, like, Rob Portman is making calls to people like, you know, Mike Fitzpatrick, and or not Mike Fitzpatrick, Brian Fitzpatrick in the Philadelphia suburbs, a moderate Republican, saying, like, you've got to support this. And Don Bacon, you know, in Nebraska, you got to support this. So it seems like the votes probably are there if push comes to shove. But then, you know, we'll just have to see on the broader bill, because it sounds like they really do want to get this thing going.
Well, and in the broader bill, they've made a lot of promises to a lot of groups. And so they're balancing that of who are they going to let down, who thinks that they might have a once-in-a-generation chance to get their priorities recognized by Congress. And we're seeing this just in the child care portion alone. The amount of money that Democrats want to spend on child care is transformative, is what I'm hearing from the advocates. And the idea that they might not get this money could keep people from turning out in 2022. I mean, the people, I don't want to say that this could be a determining factor in whether they vote, but I think Maya's really right that if Democrats have this to point to, they're going to be a lot better off than if they've got a lot of disgruntled, politically active advocates who didn't quite get everything they were promised.
And Alex, what do we know about, like, what the president's going to be up to the next couple of weeks? I take it there are no international trips on his schedule. He's going to keep close to home here, huh?
Well, yeah, you know, he is going to keep close to home. You know, they said after the series of meetings this week with Democratic lawmakers that those discussions would be ongoing, first at a staff level. I think it's a safe bet that the president is going to be personally engaged on this. And in fact, Jen Psaki has made reference to the fact that, you know, now that we are closer to the finish line on any number of the items we've been discussing, that the president, that it, you know, makes sense, it follows that the president would be more personally engaged on this. I think we are also going to see him, you know, he has traveled within the country to tout the entire Build Back Better agenda. I think it's a fair bet, Jason, we're going to see that, in part because of what Sarah and Maya are referencing, you know, that he still needs to build support for this agenda, right, with the public. He still needs to even let people know what's in the legislation. I think one of the challenges Democrats have had, that in this $3.5 trillion piece of legislation. You know, if you just take the reconciliation bill, there are so many different items that it's hard to pitch it all at once, right? It's hard to really focus on any of the individual items because there are so many different programs that are getting funded. And we've even seen polling to the effect of, you know, it has public support. But I think there was a Pew poll that came out yesterday that showed, yes, 49% of people support the legislation, 25% or so oppose it, which means a whole lot of folks didn't have an opinion about this reconciliation bill. And I think you see that when you talk to a lot of Democrats, that there still is a kind of a murkiness even among the politically engaged about what exactly is in this legislation. So I think as much as the president is trying to help negotiate on Capitol Hill, you're going to see him out and about in the country and possibly through the media also trying to sell this piece of legislation to the public to even let them know what's in the legislation.
Well, we will buckle up these next few weeks because, again, you know, we won't go into the extensive sports metaphors at our disposal. But, you know, this is, you know, like crunch time, fourth quarter, overtime, you name it. And I appreciate you all going through sort of step by step. What's this weird, you know, kind of three dimensional chess that we're dealing with the debt limit and the shutdown and the two infrastructure packages. We're going to talk now. We're going to pivot away from some of the, you know, that stuff to just a story that sort of spoke to us, as is our wont here on the Reporters Roundtable. Maya, let's start with you. What was the story that caught your eye this week?
Yes. So I am, again, looking at a story that came out about 2 weeks ago, but it's new to me. It's a really great item in The Atlantic from Hannah Georges about how Hollywood's writers' rooms look nothing like the rest of America and how that's impacted a lot of the TV that we watch. Just because you have a lot of shows that depict Black families, but the writers' rooms are very white. And so it's this really fun, amazing look. Hannah just gets all of these great actors and actresses who are kind of like canon in Black TV to talk about their experiences. Folks from Kenya Barris to Shonda Rhimes, who have been held up in many ways as these pillars of Black entertainment, but looks at how really new a lot of these creators are to actually running their own shows and depicting Black TV. It's a pretty long read, but I learned so much about it or about Black TV and learned so much from Hannah and her reporting here, just looking at all of these different shows over the years. So if you subscribe to The Atlantic or get the magazine in print, it was the September cover story. So highly recommend you give it a long read if you haven't already.
Awesome. Sarah, how about you?
Well, I'm a bit of a science nerd, so I have been enjoying news of fossilized footprints discovered in New Mexico. If they've been verified, and it would move up the date that they think the early humans arrived in North America to about 23,000 years ago. My folks are in New Mexico, and so I'm fascinated to maybe get a chance to go explore White Sands National Park here next time I visit them.
Excellent. Yeah, that is, if anybody is contemplating a trip to New Mexico, I must highly recommend being a former resident of the Four Corners area. It is stunning and unlike any place you've ever been, really. No, that's very cool. Alex, your story that really popped for you this week.
Well, Sarah and Maya referenced really great, important stories. Mine is that they spotted another zebra in suburban Maryland. This is a truly bizarre story if you haven't been following it, but a handful of zebras were released from Prince George's County inadvertently several weeks back. Our local delegate here in Washington, D.C., Eleanor Holmes Norton, has denied responsibility for releasing the zebras, which really caught me off guard. I hadn't been following, but just yesterday there's a story on the local Fox affiliate. Someone saw a zebra crossing the road as they were driving. And I can't imagine what my or anyone's reaction would be if I just saw a zebra prancing around my home. So that's my moment of zen.
I'm kind of on the side of the zebras in all of this.
I think we all are.
Yeah, I'm kind of rooting for their freedom here.
I'm just imagining, you'll appreciate this, Jason, as a cinephile, the scene in Michael Clayton when he gets out of his car and he's just staring at this serene horse in the distance. Yes. And instead of a horse, it's a zebra. So
yes, and it's near Upper Marlboro.
Yes,
it's near instead Upper of upstate Marlboro. New York.
Exactly. That's the remade version of Michael Clayton.
Oh, that's awesome. My story is a silly one. It is for those of you who are literature and sort of modern novel fans. Haruki Murakami is you know among the greats among us Japanese author and you know the writer of novels like Sputnik Sweetheart and so forth and Kafka at the Beach, and he had this great essay that adapted from a forthcoming book that was in the New Yorker about the fact that he has too many t-shirts. And Alex, as somebody who has worked with me for a while, you know that I do have a t-shirt problem. It was almost as if I thought, oh, now I don't get to write this book. But it is about his accumulation of t-shirts in strange ways and how he is running out of space to store them. And then, and the circumstances under which he gets a lot of the t-shirts. And so the book has a sort of mini essay on each and every t-shirt. And the one that he adapted for the New Yorker was about his I put ketchup on my ketchup t-shirt that he acquired and what it says about Americans' love of ketchup and so forth. And I just thought, this is truly, if he's speaking to nobody else in the world, he is speaking to me. A man who is constantly battling the t-shirts rolling out of his drawers and closets. So I highly recommend. And also, like, I mean, if all the stories that we've talked about, Maya, Sarah's, and Alex, I mean, they just they're needed in weeks like this.
Jason, I'm just glad you have a new role model. You found a new role model. It's good to see.
It's a long time coming. All right. That's going to do it for this edition of the Bill Press Pod. Thank you for listening, and thank you to our panelists for their time and insight. Really appreciate you hopping by the pod this morning. Maya King, politics reporter for Politico, Sarah Weyer, Congress reporter for the LA Times, and Alex Rorty, White House correspondent for McClatchy News. I'm Jason Dick, deputy editor at CQ Roll Call, your guest host. Have a great weekend, everybody.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.